Welcome to Base by Base, the Papalcast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Okay, let's unpack this. When we think about the fundamental process of sexual reproduction meiosis, it really hinges entirely on the precise shuffling of genetic material.
The process we call crossover recombination.
Right. But the thing is, this isn't random. Imagine trying to arrange just a few essential events along your ridiculously tiny, crowded chromosome, making sure they're all perfectly spaced. The cell can't just, you know, throw darts at a board.
No, it needs a ruler. A very, very precise ruler.
Exactly.
And, well, for over a century, geneticists have known that these crossovers are not random. The creation of one actively interferes with another one forming nearby.
And that's crossover interference, or COI?
COI, yes. And its main job is to ensure that these crossovers are spread out evenly, which is just absolutely critical for shuffling alleles and, honestly, for guaranteeing fertility. It's such an elegant example of, you know, one-dimensional patterning in biology. But here's the puzzle. The massive puzzle that's been around for decades. Genetically, we can detect way more crossovers than the number we can actually see under a microscope. Those visible ones are the so-called canonical crossovers.
But there are these missing events. The minority crossovers, we've always known the canonical ones are beautifully regulated, but this minority group, they've been a total enigma.
Yeah, the old dogma was basically that the main crossovers are highly regulated, they interfere, and the minority ones are just, well, what was the term?
Randomly sprinkled, just sort of thrown in as an afterthought.
Randomly sprinkled, right. This deep dive completely changes that, revealing that this elegant process actually creates not one, but two complex interwoven patterns.
It really does. Today we're diving into a study that used a highly rigorous quantitative approach to finally solve this mystery. Our understanding of meiotic crossover patterning is, I mean, it's dramatically advanced thanks to the work of Martin A. White, Beth Wiener, Lingluo Chu, Jubum Lim, Mar Prentice, and Nancy Kleckner.
So the mission, as the researchers saw it, was razor sharp. Get past just counting spots under a microscope and really understand the physical basis of COI. And of course, find those missing crossovers.
Right. To set the stage, we know the canonical crossovers, the ones we can see, are linked to these visible recombination complexes. You see them as these bright spots, or foci, of proteins like ZIP3.
And they're all lined up along the synaptonemal complex, the SEC.
That's the ladder-like structure holding the chromosomes together. And those events, the canonical ones, show that classic interference pattern.
And the big question mark is still that minority set. Like you said, people just figured they were, I don't know, mistakes, aberrant outcomes of other interactions.
Exactly. And the assumption was, if you can't see them, they must not be interfering. They're just biological noise.
But that assumption has a huge flaw, right? It's all based on what we can see.
It's entirely based on counting bright, discrete spots. What if the minority crossovers are real, but their protein complexes are just smaller or dimmer, or maybe just too close to the big ones for a standard microscope to tell them apart?
You'd never see them. And if you can't see them, you can't measure their spacing. And if you can't measure their spacing, you can never prove they're regulated.
Precisely. So that was the technical hurdle they had to overcome.
So how did they do it? How did they see the invisible?
They had to completely change their approach. They shifted from counting spots to analyzing the continuous signal. They used budding yeast and did this incredibly precise imaging, staining for three key molecules all at once.
Okay, what were they?
So you have ZIP3, which is a core crossover component, then HOP1, which is part of the chromosome's structural axis.
And the third.
And ZIP1, which makes up the rungs of that SC ladder we mentioned.
So you have the crossover machinery, the chromosome axis, and the structure holding it all together, a triple threat.
It is. But instead of looking for three bright spots stacked on top of each other, they went into signal processing. They generated these precise, quantitative signal intensity profiles.
So like a seismograph for a chromosome.
That's a great way to put it. They literally traced the entire length of the chromosome, micrometer by micrometer, and recorded the signal strength for all three of those proteins at every single point.
I'm picturing a graph, and I'm guessing that raw data must have looked incredibly messy.
Oh, it was. The profiles were this complex mix of sharp, narrow peaks, which is where we thought the canonical crossovers were, but they were sitting on top of these broader, wavier fluctuations all along the chromosome. You couldn't make sense of it just by looking.
And this is where the really innovative math comes in.
This is the genius of the paper. To dissect all that complexity, they used a technique from physics and engineering. It's called Fast Fourier Transform, or FFT.
Right, FFT. So it's like taking a complex sound wave and breaking it down into the individual notes that make it up.
That is a perfect analogy. It takes that messy, wavy signal from the chromosome, and it finds the simple, repeating patterns hidden inside it. The spatial periodicities.
So it's looking for a rhythm in the noise.
It's finding the rhythm. And then, and this is the really cool part, they used inverse FFT, or IFFT.
Okay.
And with IFFT, they could basically rebuild the signal using only one of those rhythms at a time. So they could look at just the shortwave pattern, or turn that off and look at just the long wave pattern.
Wow. So they could mathematically separate these patterns even if they were physically right on top of each other, completely blurred together under the microscope?
Exactly. It's like having computational super resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And this ability to quantify the patterning, not just count foci, it led to this cascade of discoveries.
Okay, so what was the first big insight?
First, the FFT analysis confirmed it. There are two core periodicities. All three molecules, ZIP3, HOP1, and ZIP1, showed signals that were clearly centered around two different patterns. There was a shorter one at about 0.5 micrometers, and a longer one at about 1.2 micrometer.
So right there, that's the physical evidence. It's not just one set of spots. There were two regulated arrays in the data.
Two distinct regulated arrays. And that led to the second insight, the triad structure. The IFFT analysis showed that for both the short and long patterns, the peaks for ZIP3, HOP1, and ZIP1 weren't independent. They were clustered tightly together in what the team called triads.
So all three molecules are in the same place?
Essentially, yes. The distance between them was tiny, only about 0.007 micrometers. So every pattern site is this unified complex with the crossover machinery, the axis, and the SC component all working together.
That suggests a really deep interconnected role. It's not just a crossover happening on the chromosome, it's integrated with the chromosome structure.
It does. Which leads to insight number three. Shorter triads match canonical COs. The shorter ones, the 0.5 micrometer ones, were a dead ringer for the canonical crossovers we already knew about.
The spacing was right, everything.
Everything. The spacing was right, and their interference was strong. They used a statistic for this, the location coefficient of coincidence, or an ELCOCSI.
Let's pause on that because that's key. What does an ELCOCSI number tell you?
So an ELCOCSI near one means there's no interference, things are basically random. But as ELCOCSI gets closer to zero, the interference gets stronger and stronger. The events are actively pushing each other away.
And the short triads.
They had an ELCOCSI between 0.27 and 0.32. That is classic, strong interference. And when they use mutants known to reduce interference, the ELCOCSI went up. Just as you'd expect.
Okay, so strong interference, 0.5 micrometer spacing. Yep. The shorter triad is the canonical crossover. Case closed on that one.
Methodology proven.
Now for the big one.
Yeah.
The conceptual revolution. What about that longer group?
That's insight number four. Longer triads are pattern minority COs. These longer triads, the ones spaced at about 1.0 micrometer, they also showed strong interference. In fact, their interference was even stronger.
Wait, stronger? How so?
Well, their ELSKETA was between 0.58 and 0.62. Now that number is higher, but it's measured relative to their own wider spacing rules.
Mm-hmm.
The key point is that it's absolutely not random. It's nowhere near one.
So this just completely torpedoes the old idea that minority crossovers are non-interfering.
It demolishes it. They are strongly regulated, and it seems to be by the very same machinery that regulates the canonical ones.
And they're not just separate, are they? What about their position relative to the short ones?
That's the beautiful part.
Yeah.
They are interdigitated. They're woven in between the shorter triads. The team found that the median distance from a long triad to its nearest short triad was 0.27 micrometers.
And why is that specific number so important?
Because that is the smoking gun. That distance, 0.27 micrometers, is almost a perfect match for the known distance between two adjacent uncommitted sites where a recombination could happen, which is about 0.23 micrometers.
So it's like the long triads are forming in the very next available slot right next to where a short one already formed.
Exactly. And then you have the clincher. The ratio.
The numbers have to match.
They do.
Yeah.
The ratio of longer triads to shorter triads they saw was about 0.5 to 1. And the known genetic ratio of minority crossovers to canonical crossovers, it's about 0.46 to 1.
That's the same number.
It's an incredible match. This is the strongest evidence yet that these longer triads are the minority crossovers we've been looking for all this time.
Unbelievable. So what was the last piece of the puzzle?
The final insight, number five, was about fine-tuning. There's a protein remodeler called PT2, and the team found the PT is specifically focusing its activity on the longer periodicity triads.
So it's not managing the main canonical sites, it's fine-tuning the secondary minority sites.
Precisely. In mutants without PGE2, those longer triad peaks got substantially taller. It suggests PGE2 is normally there to kind of tamp down the component loading at these minority sites, managing the second tier of patterning.
Okay, let's connect all these dots. We have two patterned arrays, both using ZMM proteins, both showing strong interference. What does this mean for the whole model of recombination?
It means we need a unified theory. It tells us that canonical and minority crossovers aren't separate things. They arise from a single, unified process that just happens in two sequential tiers.
It throws out the random sprinkling idea and replaces it with highly regulated spatial organization.
Completely.
But, okay, if it's the same basic interference process, how does it create two different arrays with two different spacing rules?
The evidence points to a sequential model. I like to call it the two-round draft pick model.
Ah, okay, I like that. Walk me through the draft.
So in round one, the canonical crossovers go first, the shorter triads. They're the first round picks. They land at the prime spots, dictated by the strongest interference signals, and they immediately create these zones around them where another crossover is unlikely to form.
So they use the ruler, they claim their spots, and the spots next door are now repressed.
Exactly. Then you have round two. The minority crossovers, the longer triads, arise after that. They form at the leftover sites that still have the highest residual potential. And where are those sites?
They have to be in the gaps between the first round picks.
Precisely. Which naturally explains the interdigitation and the wider, different spacing rules for the second set. It's an incredibly efficient system.
It is. The cell maximizes the spacing for the first set, and then it comes back and fills in the gaps, maximizing spacing again. It ensures the whole chromosome gets covered.
Which brings us back to that triad structure. Why the three components, ZIP3, HOP1, and ZIP1, at every single site?
Well, one idea could be that they're just there to stabilize the DNA exchange, to make sure the crossover event actually completes.
That's part of it, for sure. But the presence of HOP1 and ZIP1, these very structural proteins, hints at something more mechanical. A crossover isn't just swapping DNA.
Right, you have to physically break and rejoin the entire chromosome axis.
Yes. So these triads might be the machinery that promotes that necessary axis exchange. ZIP1 and HOP1 could be essential for that physical reorganization to create a continuous, stable chromosome at the end.
The take-home message here really feels like a complete redefinition of those minority crossovers. They aren't mistakes, they're not noise.
Not at all. They are a highly regulated, integral part of a two-tiered system designed to maximize genetic exchange and ensure mechanical stability.
So to sum it all up,
crossover interference is a two-tiered spatial patterning process. It creates two interwoven arrays of these molecular triads. The shorter ones are the canonical crossovers we knew about, and the longer ones, well, they're the minority crossovers, which, contrary to everything we assumed, are strongly patterned by the exact same mechanism.
It just tells us that genetic shuffling is so much more strictly regulated right down to the events we used to dismiss than we ever imagined.
And that leads to the big question, right? What does this two-tiered sequential mechanism, this sort of highly regulated safety net for recombination, what does it mean for our understanding of things like fertility defects in humans, where so many problems stem from recombination errors?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.